welcome to Tea and Strumpets, a Regency romance review. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Kelsey.
And we're back with our Bridgerton happily ever afters. These are much requested, and we're recording this a little ahead of time because this is going to be our first episode that will air during my maternity leave. So I should have had my kid by now.
This is a really ironic thing to be the start of the maternity leave episodes. I know.
This particular subject just happened. Yeah. So it was also a really interesting happily ever after to revisit. I sort of remembered what happened in this happily ever after, but I feel like this one is actually really different from all the others.
I would agree with that as well. I will also caveat this. Any listeners, any new listeners, if this is the first happily ever after you've been encountered, let me give you just a little bit of information. Julia Quinn wrote second happily ever afters of all the Bridgerton books. So these are second epilogues. So if you have not yet read this book and it's on your list of books to read, maybe don't listen to this episode yet. Or just be aware that this is an epilogue to an epilogue, so there are a million and one spoilers.
Absolutely.
And it spoils the other books too sometimes, just letting you know.
Yes, they do for sure. And we also have a trigger warning for the subject matter of this, which I will also say is the same trigger warning for Francesca's book in general, When He Was Wicked, and that is infertility and miscarriage. So with that, shall we recap the epilogue, the first epilogue from When He Was Wicked?
Yes, we will recap that.
It's so short.
Yeah, it's really short. So this epilogue of Francesca's book is a letter from her former mother-in-law because it is, they sent her a letter announcing that she has married Michael, John's cousin, and it is basically a letter of acceptance of the couple, excitement for the couple, happy that the couple are together because John loved them both so much, and therefore he would love the fact that they are together since he is no longer with them.
Yep. And that is it.
That's it. And it's beautiful, though. It's just a beautiful way to end this book. Oh, I love this book. Someone was asking me about it, and I was like, it's so heartbreakingly beautiful.
It is, but it also, like, your heart is full at the end of it. However, as Julia Quinn mentions before the second epilogue, she felt like the book was very complete. She felt like Francesca's story was very complete, but a lot of readers didn't. They really wanted to know whether Francesca ever realized her dream of becoming a mother. And so we're going to find out about that today as we recap the second epilogue of When He Was Wicked.
Yes. So we're going to take that away right now.
So Francesca has been married for 3 years and she has not yet conceived. She is very sad about this, although she tries to see all the other good in her life and find fulfillment with her husband and in her new role as aunt to a ton of little Bridgertons.
Yes.
But she is a very private person and she has not shared how she really feels about her infertility with anyone, in so many words, and not even her husband, Michael.
Michael does realize that there is nothing he can do to make Francesca fully happy because he cannot give her the child she so desires. But he loves her fiercely regardless.
And one visit to her family, Francesca finally opens up a little bit to her mother, having a hard time finding all the words, but admitting how devastated her infertility has made her.
However, this unloading of feelings is akin to a grieving process, and it actually allows her to finally let go of some of that and accept the infertility and move on.
And luckily, she has a handsome and virile husband who loves her very much. And her newfound acceptance of herself and her situation leads to a outdoor romp where she takes control and we have a saucy encounter.
As all of Michael and Francesca's encounters are.
Yes.
Perhaps it was the release of the stress or the acceptance, but soon Francesca realizes that she may have missed her courses. Michael is bewildered and terrified, for he feels that if she loses another baby, she won't recover from it. So he sets about making sure she is quite coddled through her pregnancy.
Francesca, for her part, is very certain of two things. One, that she will not lose this baby, and two, that it is a boy.
Both turn out to be true. Our epilogue ends when she returns to visit her family a year later with baby John in tow. She decided to enjoy the pregnancy as something for just her and Michael to share, and so her family was completely in the dark until they arrived. At that trip, much happiness ensues, and while her family gets to know John, Francesca and Michael conceive their second child, a daughter named Janet.
Oof. A lot happens and a lot of time passes in this second epilogue. And
yes.
Okay, first of all, it's way longer than I think all of the other second epilogues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a lot more going on, more pieces into play here. But also, too, like, it kind of makes sense because Francesca's story in general was such a departure from the others as well.
Yes. And I think this is the only one with a, like, explicit encounter in it where, you know, you kind of know where everybody's limbs are. For example, actually, Kat Sebastian put something up on Twitter that was so cute. I'm going to try to pull it up. So Kat Sebastian tweeted this like proposed heat level rating system, which I actually liked. And I think we do this when we talk about how steamy something is, right?
Yeah.
But she said a one is no sex either on or off page. Two is off page sex. Three is on page sex, vaguely described. Four is on page sex where you know where people's body parts are most of the time. And five is minutely described on page sex. She calls it the anatomy lesson. So I think that, and I think that's what we're trying to say with our steaminess rating.
Yeah.
You know? However, I think this one was like, well, this was a four. Like, we knew where people's body parts were most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where I think like in one of the earlier ones with either Kate or Daphne, we maybe had a three on page sex vaguely described.
Yes. I will say that's – I remember that in some of the others. I think it was like Daphne's book. You know, it was a lot – like you knew they had a romp in the sheets, but it wasn't explained in more detail than that.
Yeah, so I think that this one is you know interesting in that, but it, like you said, it's very much the tone of their book and their romance, and so it feels very natural because sometimes I've even found in other books when they throw a sex scene into an epilogue, it almost feels like gratuitous, like it doesn't feel like it's really. I don't know. It's like it's not – it doesn't feel as rewarding as maybe another kind of aspect of – knowing another aspect of their lives would.
Yes. And I mean we've talked – that's a good thing to talk about just in romance novels in general. And I think that's – I was talking to friends about it actually because it's kind of comparing it to sex scenes in movies and shows these days. A lot of times there seems to be lately – and even from me who reads a lot of romance novels, like I feel like sometimes there's just gratuitous sex in a movie or show, and it doesn't really do anything for the plot or character development. It's just kind of there for to make it scintillating, you know? And then sometimes I'm like, I don't really need to watch this because it doesn't do anything for this plot. It's just like a 5-minute scene of limbs and things, and what's it doing for anyone? And so I feel like same thing, the reason the sex in the romance novels, you know, it's a plot-driving device. You know, it's part of the character's development with each other. It's part of the relationship and the development of that. So a lot of times in these second epilogues, we don't need an explicit scene because this is also a second epilogue. We know the happily ever after. Like, we don't necessarily need a scene that's explicit versus in this one, there's a conception of a child. And there's only one way to do that, as far as I'm aware.
Well, but I think it actually, like you said, it feels natural though with their romance and their relationship. And it's part of, like, you know, Francesca accepting who she is and taking charge in her life. Like, because she kind of takes charge in this particular encounter, I think there's, it's like really is this kind of freeing moment for her, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she's having this kind of come to terms moment with herself. And I think that that's important. You know, so we do need to talk about her having a baby. I think that, you know, right now, a lot of modern readers are actually really interested in books where the heroine chooses not to have a baby or can't conceive, but is, you know, but grieves maybe that process, but is okay with it. I think a lot of readers have issues with the quote unquote miracle baby trope. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to argue against miracle baby here because Francesca, you know, obvious. The thing that I find a little hard is that it's very clear from the beginning that she always has her courses. Like, she has very regular periods. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so if the author had chosen to say something like she didn't have very regular periods, I think that that immediately makes it slightly, not slightly, it just immediately makes it like more conceivable that mm-hmm. it could be more difficult to conceive, right? Because yes. you're not ovulating regularly. You don't have a 1 to 2 day window every 30 days. You have a 1 to 2 day window occasionally. And there might be other things that condition causes that makes it difficult for you to, you know, implant and all of those things. But I'm sure that there are also plenty of people out there who do have regular periods who cannot conceive. I just think that as a reader, it's like maybe a little bit easier to forgive the idea if there's a clear.
Yeah, where it just is like, it's very clear that it's like, you know, doesn't know her body as well. It's hard to track, you know, then it's like, okay, well then you just don't know.
Yeah. However, she's already as a character shown that she can conceive, right? She's mm-hmm. She's had a miscarriage and it's possible she's had more miscarriages. Although again, she was tracking her cycles so clearly and everything was so on time that like they would have been, you know, very, very, very early miscarriages. Like it.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the point is, there is a lot to me as a reader that kind of works for Francesca's conception. You know, I think that you hear a lot in general about stress and, you know, outside influence, mental factors being also kind of impeding conception for many people. And so I think this kind of transformative time with her mom and her family and just kind of coming to terms with it and not being so stressed out about it, it did allow her, right, to conceive in whatever way it is. And I have heard real life stories about people like that very frequently. So well, I don't necessarily feel this is a miracle baby.
Yeah. And I think that everything about Francesca is just very much reserved and internal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of how she's chosen her life. Her book is very different from the others because there isn't a lot of sibling interaction. There really isn't a lot of familial interaction. She's kind of on her own. Even the way she chooses to go about her pregnancy, she doesn't tell anyone. She just is like, something is different. We need to leave now. Like, I can tell something is different. We need to go home. And then comes back, you know, a year later with a child in tow and surprises everyone for that. But that's also very much her in that sense, too.
Absolutely. She's a private person. And I mean, she ends up not telling her family about her pregnancy even at all.
No, she literally shows up with a baby and she comes out of the carriage holding a baby and Violet's like, what?
And I have to say, I think that's my favorite part in a way because I actually really empathize with that. Like, especially as someone who had a baby during COVID and kind of, you know, didn't have the opportunity to share my baby with everybody that I wanted to. Mm-hmm. At the same time, like keeping the knowledge of it to yourself, like I totally respect that. I mean, she's been through a lot. If she loses the baby, she doesn't necessarily want to share that grief with everyone immediately.
Or
you know?
Have the pity of, you know, her very fertile siblings.
Yeah. And so like for her, the better path is probably to not tell people. And I can understand you start by not telling and then you're like, how do I tell everybody? And literally like when the pandemic started, I was pregnant and I hadn't yet told anybody at my work because it was very early. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up telling my work kind of late just because, you know, later than most people would, just because it like never felt right. And it was, again, long distance and Zoom. And I was like, I feel like I need to tell my immediate boss and my HR manager like face to face. Not that they were going to be upset, but it just seemed like the kind of news that you say, hey, I'm pregnant. And you're like, it's not just like an email you send.
Yeah, it's not an email say, hey, BT Dubs, what's your maternity leave policy again? Yeah,
so I can see how Francesca might be like, I don't really want to write a letter saying I'm pregnant and then, you know, it takes 6 weeks to get from Scotland to London or whatever it actually takes. But like, and then have something change and then have her mom, you know, like I can see that like you, that all those hesitations lead to just you have the baby. Like,
yeah.
And like, I just think it's such a beautiful reveal, you know, coming out of the carriage and mm-hmm. having the baby. I kind of love that. I guess I don't know. So I think when I first read this, you were mentioning to me before we brought back this, before we got into this reread, you said, oh, I remember you really didn't like this one, right?
You were really against the miracle baby at the time. Okay. I think, I don't know what, I mean, our opinions change, you know, at the time you were like, eh, I'm not too fond of like the miracle baby trope, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think like as someone who also was told that it may be hard for me to conceive, I liked reading stories that were diverse as far as people who maybe did or weren't, you know, were or weren't able to carry a baby. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw the value in having stories about women who couldn't have kids. I think, I don't know, this time, like you said, my perspective has changed a little bit, not because I had a kid, but because I feel like there's kind of enough justification in there. Mm-hmm. You know, some of it's a little wishy-washy, but ultimately just reading this one kind of made me feel happy.
I just, you know, I'm just a big fan of Francesca in general. I just love her. And I think for me, this made me happy only because I knew how much she wanted to have a child. And then to actually have one, you know, was just like, good for you, Francesca.
Yeah.
You go, girl.
But something I really did ponder, and she had a great conversation with Eloise in this one about like, do you love your adopted children any mm-hmm. less than your, you know, your biological children? And Eloise was like, absolutely not, you know?
Yeah.
And I think Francesca could have had a beautiful happily ever after that included an adopted child.
Absolutely. I think that she easily could have. And I think this book also was really good because there were so few interactions with her family in her actual book. I think one thing I liked about the second epilogue too is she had really great conversations like with her family, her conversation with Violet, mm-hmm. you mentioned her conversation with Eloise. All those were really much like, you know, she is a part of the family even though she's not as much in the family as, you know, the others are. She's not as on the forefront, which I will say watching the Bridgerton series, I'm kind of like, where's Francesca? She's like there in some scenes and not there in others. And I'm like, where is she? She's the best.
She is. However, I think they're doing a good job of making her kind of this more reclusive sibling. They're taking it a little bit literally. So that in that way, it's nice. Also, interesting fact that maybe was in one of the other books, but is definitely in this epilogue is that she and Eloise, Francesca and Eloise, share a birthday 1 year apart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of fun. I didn't remember that.
Which is why I think it's so interesting. Only another thing in the series is because the way it's casted, Francesca looks so much younger than Eloise. And I'm like, yeah, but they're really the same year. Mm-hmm. Like, they're very actually close in age.
Yeah. Well, there were some really beautiful quotes in this one, and I actually wanted to share one of them. There was a Kate and Anthony sort of mention here, which I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Violet crossed the room to peek down at her newest grandchild. Little Mary had been a bit of a surprise, coming so many years after Charlotte. Kate had thought herself done with childbearing, but then, 10 months earlier, she'd gotten out of bed, walked calmly to the chamber pot, emptied the contents of her stomach, and announced to Anthony, "I believe we're expecting again." I was just like, that's such a... Anyhow, but the one I really wanted to share is this. It just blew my eyes away. So this is when Violet is first meeting little baby John. "He has your eyes," Violet said, looking up at Francesca. Franny nodded, and her smile was almost silly, as if she couldn't quite believe it. "I know. And your mouth. I think you're right. And your, oh my, I think he has your nose as well." "I'm told," Michael said in an amused voice, "that I was involved in his creation too, but I have yet to see any evidence." Francesca looked at him with so much love that it nearly took Violet's breath away. "He has your charm," she said.
No.
I literally was like tearing up at that moment. And then when Violet takes him, like Violet basically is like, "Francesca, Michael, go away. I'm taking John with me." And we're,
yeah.
And she says, "Come with me, little one," she whispered. "I have so much to tell you." And I also started crying there. I was like,
yeah,
I can't help myself. I mean, I am pregnant, very pregnant. So that helps with the emotion, especially when it comes to baby stuff. However, it just was so sweet. It was so, so, so sweet.
Yeah. I mean, everything about it really is. Oh, my gosh. Ugh, but I have the quote from the letter in the epilogue.
Uh-huh.
The final line. Ugh. It's from John's mom. And the last line is, "And I hope you will not think me foolish when I also extend my thanks. Thank you, Michael, for letting my son love her first."
Ugh. There's totally a different tone and maturity to when he was Wicked and mm-hmm. the second epilogue. It's quite interesting because, like, you know, when I think about certain authors, like they, even if their stories are very different, even if the tropes are very different, usually like the tone is very similar. Mm-hmm. For example, Kat Sebastian, who I mentioned earlier, like, she has very varied stories, diverse, you know, different genders and sexual orientations. And at the base level, but also she had just has like a very clear voice, and like her mm-hmm. tone is very sarcastic and witty. As I could say similarly of Julia Quinn, but I just feel like that, like if you think about this book versus even like Colin and Penelope's book, they're very different.
They're very different. Like that one's Penelope and Colin's, as we talked about, it's like it's light and fluffy and perfect in all its light and fluffiness, you know.
Yeah.
But this book's a little darker, a little bit more mature. It deals with very strong emotions mm-hmm. and like really strong peaks and valleys as far as like the characters and their emotional states throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
And their driving forces. So it's very different from the light and fluffy Penelope and Colin.
Yeah. I am glad we revisited it because, as we have already discussed, I had very different opinions this time around. And I think that is really interesting.
It is. And so fun.
Yes. Well, before we go, we just want to remind you that if you'd like to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at T as in Tom, N as in Nancy Strumpets, Facebook / T and Strumpets, and YouTube by searching our name.
And if you have not already, please go ahead and check out our Patreon. Woo. Yes, we have three lovely tiers for people to join. We have the ton at $3 a month. And then if you want to do a little bit more, then you will get your voucher to AllMax at $5 a month. And if you just think we're the bestest and you want to show your love, you can join the aristocracy and have a lord or lady in front of your name for $10 a month. With that, we have lots of fun goodies that you get with each tier. One thing that we definitely will extend in all our tiers is our undying love and gratitude.
Absolutely. And our show is and always will be free. And if you want to show your support in a non-monetary way, you can subscribe to us on YouTube or your podcatcher of choice, or tell a friend. Share the podcast with someone who you think might love it. So we love all the ways that you guys have supported us, and we're just so grateful that you are listening to us today.
Yes. And speaking of listening to us, what will we be doing next time, Zoe?
Next time, we're finally getting back to Maiden Lane.
Woo!
Oh, and it is... It is a good one. We are going to be reading Thief of Shadows by Elizabeth Hoyt.
Cannot wait. It's very exciting.
So thank you all so much for joining us, and join us again next episode as we read Thief of Shadows by Elizabeth Hoyt.
And may all your ever afters end happily.